Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. In tonight's episode, episode 9, we explore sound painting with its creator, Walter Thompson, and name the episode Rhythm Analyst Number 1. Sound painting is the universal, multidisciplinary, live composing sign language for musicians, actors, dancers, and visual artists. The language comprises more than 1,200 gestures that are signed by the sound painter or composer to indicate the level of material desired of the performers. The creation of the composition is realized by the sound painter through the parameters of each set of sign gestures. The sound painter, standing in front of the group, communicates a series of signs using hand and body gestures, indicating specific or aleatoric material to be performed by the group. The sound painter develops the responses of the performers, molding and shaping them into the composition, then signs another series of gestures, a phrase, and continues in this process of composing the piece. The sound painter composes in real time, utilizing the gestures to create the composition in any way they desire. The sound painter sometimes knows what he or she will receive from the performers, and sometimes does not know what will be received, the elements of specificity and chance. The sound painter composes with what happens in the moment, whether expected or not. The ability to compose with what happens in that moment, in real time, is what is required in order to attain a high level of fluency with the sound painting language. The gestures of the sound painting language are signed using the syntax of who, what, how, and when. There are many types of gestures, some indicating specific material to be formed, as well as others indicating specific styles, genres, aleatoric concepts, improvisation, disciplines, stage positions, costumes, props, and many others. The sound painting language was created by Walter Thompson in Woodstock, New York, in 1974. And Walter joins us today on Geographical Imaginations. I've been thinking the last couple of years about rhythm as a way of kind of seeing the world, but I don't have a musical background. I'm coming from it from this idea, more of a social science kind of background, and thinking, for instance, urban spaces have rhythms. But how do we, as social scientists, how can we be creative about how we approach that? So this right. kind of came to me, and I thought, well, I especially was, my interest was sort of piqued because you had talked about some of the language and some of the, even the syntax around the signs and such developed out of observation of just kind of urban scenes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That is where a great deal of the language, I mean, some of it comes from, sort of music structures and dance structures and visual art structures and ways of composing and theater. And then some of the gestures were influenced by, real happenings in real life and trying to kind of recreate that concept for a multidisciplinary performance, for example. Do you want me to elaborate on one of them for you?
Yeah. Do you have a good example of one of the signs that you did borrow?
Yes, it's called
borrow.
Coming and Going.
Uh-huh.
Coming and Going. And I was in, I live in Sweden now, but I'm from New York City. I've lived in Sweden now almost 13, 14 years, something like that. But anyway, I was waiting for a friend in Times Square. It was like Broadway and 42nd Street, and it was at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So there was a lot of people on the street just getting out of work. And I was leaning against a building so I didn't get run over by the crowd, you know,
right,
kind of tucked back away and watching, you know, people walk by and waiting for a friend. And two very big crowds, one coming one direction, one coming the other direction, you know, 50, 60 people in each crowd, just like big traffic jam kind of moving, opposing each other.
Right.
And there was one person in each crowd that knew each other. The opposed crowd A had one person, crowd B going the opposite direction had one person, and they knew each other. And they were trying to say something to each other. They were trying to get to each other physically so they could talk. They just couldn't. It was just, it was too much, you know, so they couldn't get there. So I thought it was such an interesting, you know, concept, this idea of trying to make something happen, but being unable to do it just because of crowd dynamics.
Right.
And so I created coming and going based on that, which the idea of the gesture is you use this sign called coming and going. It's a specific gesture. And then you hold up a number two or number three or number five or whatever. And that tells you the number of people that you're trying to get to perform. You want two people to perform, or you want five people to perform if that's the number that you've signed. But they're unable to do so because of crowd dynamics. Hmm. And so there's all kinds of impoliteness that goes on, and there's all kinds of struggles to this is what I want to do in my life, so therefore I'm going to play. So you never really establish two people playing if that's the number.
Right.
What you do establish is this idea to have two people play, but never able to achieve it. And so this came from, you know, watching this crowd go by.
Okay, yeah.
You know, so that's one example. I mean, besides, as far as interesting what you say about the rhythm of a space,
uh-huh.
I look at, you know, pretty much my sort of, if you will, my what influences me for composition isn't usually anything to do with a piece of music or theater or dance or visual arts I've seen. It's usually something in life. And it could be like being somewhere in a city and seeing the architecture or seeing something about, you know, what's going on outside with the people. That often influences me much more because I look at things in a kind of a graphic way sometimes. If I'm really studying, like if I'm sitting at a shopping mall, which I love to do, and just watch people so that I can work with my performers in different ways to walk or different ways to behave or different ways to interact. And so if I'm just looking at a set of buildings, then I look at it as graphic notation.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find the rhythm in, it's so easy to find the rhythm in any situation if you sort of apply a visual arts approach to it, you know?
Right. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. Geographical Imaginations is an hour-long radio essay program broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. This public geography project presents a geographical or spatial way of thinking about our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. Each episode takes a theme, or perhaps a question, and explores it through an interactive dialogue with different texts and voices. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. Can you explain that a little bit more? Like, how do you see the rhythm in those experiences and those scenes?
Well, I mean, I'm a traditional composer in training. So I worked a lot with different forms of notation, not just the usual music staff, you know, that we all know when we see five lines, you know, above and five lines below for piano music, for example.
Right.
The original staff. The one of the first ways to write music. But I studied a lot of graphic notation and proportional notation, and my father was an abstract expressionist painter, and so I look at the outline of things, putting it very simple.
Mm-hmm.
You can look in an outline of anything, and then what's inside of it's another set of variables that you can interpret. But what you know, so if you look at buildings or anything, you look at the outline and you can see it as graphic notation or proportional notation. So that's one of the reasons I found inspiration less from the performing disciplines and more from just everyday life.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. I mean, I think everyday life is so rich of these different sort of scenarios and
yeah, and sometimes, you know, like I've lived in LeMay in France,
uh-huh.
and it's a small little village, you know, in Provence, and the streets can be so tight and so claustrophobic and beautiful at the same time, you know, and there's something that, you know, the sound painter, he or she will often try to go to the performance empty, you know, like there's nothing, you're not going with any expectations. It's live performance, it's live composition, I'm sorry, it's live composition. And you don't want to, before our conversation today, I didn't plan to say anything until I spoke with you.
Right.
It comes when I speak with you. So live composition is the same thing. The performers offer, you know, they make an offer related to what the sign means. You know, so the sound painter will often come to a performance empty, but yet at the same time, he or she has gathered some sort of something from life within the past 2 weeks. It's going to find its way into the art,
right?
One way or the other. And this is the reason I never, when I'm in a festival performing or I'm any place where there's a group before me, I don't see the group. You know, I don't go. I go somewhere and, you know, either stand around outside and take a walk, or I watch a science fiction film. I do something that's totally opposite of what that's no relationship to the environment I'm going to be in.
Hmm.
You know, so then that way I can come to it empty. So you can go, you know, spend. So when I was in LeMay, in these beautiful but claustrophobic little streets, you know, that found its way into my work because there's a rhythm in that. Certainly, there's a rhythm in that.
Right. That structure provides certain limitations, but also perhaps opens up even other opportunities, right?
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. And LeMay was a you know, it's not a tourist village. It's not at all, and so it's, you know, it dates back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, and so there's a lot of buildings that are, you know, at different angles and chopped up, and so graphically, it's a beautiful place to look at.
Right.
And it wound up affecting my partner Jennifer Rayfelt. It wound up affecting. She's a painter. And a very fine sound painter, and it wound up affecting her work. You know, as all visual artists are affected by, you know, what they're looking at. Always, that's whether it's a photographer, a painter, a sculptor, an installation artist, whatever. They're always affected by the area.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. You know, something unexpected in our conversation. I wasn't thinking about your. I mean, I guess you're talking about being engaged with everyday life and how much that then is going to shape and inform what you do then in the performance. I mean, that's pretty. And so even where you're living, if you're living in New York City, then, which has its own rhythm, which is very, I would say, unique than Boston's or Washington, D.C.'s or Paris's for that matter, that's going to affect the kind of performance, even though, like you're saying, like you want to show up there, not talking with the other people, the orchestra, so to speak, mm-hmm. beforehand, but you're bringing, it's almost like a magnet kind of bringing a little residue of where you've been the previous couple of weeks. have you noticed that in any performances, like arriving somewhere in relatively soon after your arrival, you've you've performed, and you have residue of New York still on you in the performance.
Residue of New York. Yeah, I can't seem to get rid of that residue.
Well, it's native, right? It's you're from there,
yeah, but,
right?
But so. Yes, I mean joking around, but yeah, I mean absolutely. I mean residue of New York, that does pop up. I mean something, you know. I consider myself a New Yorker, you know, since right. I grew up there and every whatnot, but there is certainly that residue of New York, that kind of, you know, that energy that New York has, you know, this needing to get something done, sort of, you know, this just, you know, such a fast forward kind of pace that New York. I have it today when I go driving in Sweden and people are just driving too slow. It drives me nuts. I feel like they're from New Jersey, you know. I look at the plates. You must be from New Jersey, you know. But they're not, you know.
Right.
They're from here. But nonetheless, but yes, it still finds its way into my work because there's a certain aggressive energy about being a New York performer that you see not just in sound painting, but you see in the jazz in New York or the contemporary composers' compositions or in theater. Or, you know, there's definitely a certain, you know, sort of rhythm and pace and aggressiveness that comes from the New York performer, if one can generalize, you know. If you sure. can generalize, certainly it's there. There was, you know, I was in, I can't remember the name of the village. I'm often performing in France, mm-hmm. working in France very often. And it's some little place I went to. They had set up a workshop / performance, small little village. And it's one of the villages that had been destroyed during the war, so it was built really quickly after the war, and the buildings were pretty, you know, not very attractive. Uh-huh. Not terrible, but just not attractive. And I'm used to France having just beautiful villages and cities. But anyway, so I get there, and it really brought me down. I mean, just the environment really brought me down. I don't know how much that affects other people, but it always affects me, just visually what's around. And so it made it harder for me to give the workshop on sound painting, although it was successful and all that. And it made it much harder to do the performance after the workshop with the workshop group because of the place.
Yeah.
You know, I was really brought down by the architecture, that it was so, you know, box-like.
Right, built post-war. Yeah.
Just quick build it up after the war, sort of, you know. Box buildings.
Yeah, it lost its connection to the
to the past.
Right, and I think disrupts in some ways a historical rhythm, perhaps. I don't know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. To find out more about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. To give some feedback or suggestion for a future episode, go to the comments section on the website, or go to the blog and enter into the conversation. Describe, I guess, what does it mean to go and do a workshop and then a performance? What are people learning? What is sound painting that attracts then people to do a workshop? And, you know, what does a performance look like?
Yeah. In a nutshell, I mean, sound painting is a multidisciplinary live composing, you know, sign language. Mm-hmm. You know, and anybody can learn it. So you don't have to be skilled in the performance world or the visual arts world.
Right.
You know, you could be a little kid or a doctor, a lawyer, a politician, someone with disabilities. So it works with anybody. You don't. So as a composer, coming from the traditional composing world of composing for orchestras and whatnot, also working with choreography. I'm multidisciplinary, but my main discipline has been music, but I've worked in all the other disciplines. Coming from that sort of background, I mean, it's really, you know, for me, exciting to have a tool that allows me to put anybody in a so-called orchestra, yeah, and make a composition based on who those people are and what they offer individually, not what you impose on them, which is what a composer does, and then the conductor, so-called, speaking of the traditional orchestra-composer, you know, relationship, the conductor is the guide and guides the people through, you know. They're not the writer. The conductor is the director, so to speak.
Right.
But the sound painter is the composer, you know, in real time, that works with what the people offer him or her. So when I go to teach a workshop, I mean, it's a sound painting is a language. I don't know how much you know about it, but it's straight up a sign language.
Yeah.
It began, I started it in 1974. When I lived in Woodstock, New York, and it just started by chance, really. I was frustrated, and I just made some signs during a performance, and that was the birth of it. You know, but today, and it used to be more for guiding improvisation, suggesting some things to do behind notated music or a soloist or something.
Right.
And then it's grown into this, you know, codified language of more than 1,500 signs and growing, and numerous combinations, infinite combinations of those signs, because of certain signs may allow it to be infinite. So in a workshop, I try to say it's a workshop of beginners. I'm trying to, well, not trying, but I teach the basic 45, 50 signs, mm-hmm, depending upon how many disciplines there are. And that usually takes a few hours. And as I'm teaching them, at the same time, I'm doing very short sound paintings, you know, very short compositions that might be 2 minutes long that are incorporating the signs I've just taught. So without really explaining, I'm composing. I start to compose, you know, pretty soon after the first or second sign.
So learning by doing, then getting right.
Learning by doing. And then one of the things so then at the end of the workshop, the group is, I've created my instrument. The group is the instrument for the live composer, the sound painter.
Yeah.
So at the end of the workshop, I've created the instrument. I've set certain defaults that they have to have. You know, certain defaults meaning that, you know, you play pointillism this way. Minimalism means this, you know. You can sort of reset defaults for certain gestures. They're a bit flexible, depending upon the group. And then there's the sort of a philosophy or a set of rules, very simple, that there's no such thing as a mistake. So if you do make one as a performer, you must keep on going. That's the rule. Do not stop.
Hmm.
You know, because the composer, she or he, when they're composing, the sound painter, if all of a sudden somebody stops, if you say whole group long tone, and then play, and everybody's supposed to play a long tone, depending upon their discipline, perform a long tone. If one person happens to perform pointillism by accident, let's say, which is very opposite, then that person would continue performing pointillism.
Hmm.
And then the sound painter, she or he, would have to deal with it. You deal with it. It's real. It's life, you know?
Right.
Different than a traditional composition, which you can go back and edit and shape it like you want and then hand it to the group to be played, so to speak. But the sound painter, he or she has to, like, in real time, structure and form everything. And so life is never what we expect it to be. And neither can a live composition. So the sound painter has to be, and the performers have to have a sort of a set of rules, if you will, or a philosophy,
mm-hmm,
that allows it to go no matter what happens.
Yeah, is that difficult for people to kind of let go of that?
Sorry?
Is it difficult for people to let go of that need to follow the structure? Or
incredibly so. I mean, you'd be surprised how many people will say, oh, yeah, I understand. You know, oh, Walter, why are you saying that 100 times? Because if I don't, trust me, when it comes to the performance tonight, just after the one-day workshop, a workshop performance, when it comes to that, or maybe it's not a workshop performance. Maybe it's a one-day rehearsal with a group that doesn't know sound painting. I've done this many, many times. They don't know it at all, and I only have a few hours to teach it. And I'm part of some series of performances that evening. Or it's a sound painting without anybody else. It's just sound painting. And I only have one rehearsal, you know, just one 3 or 4 hour rehearsal. You have to set this philosophy in place. So people think, oh yeah, I understand what you mean. You know, wrong and strong, you know, when in doubt, don't lay out, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then it comes to the performance and I start something and they make an error and invariably they stop, you know, and it's really hard to do that. I mean, we're taught that that life has lots of errors, you know,
right.
But that doesn't, it's not true in sound painting. The sound painter can use anything that happens.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. So is this, I came across the word aleatoric. Versus improvisation. So what's the difference here?
What's aleatoric is by chance.
Yeah.
It just means by chance.
So there's some, to use a common word, there's some serendipity to it. Is that what we would?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
So let's say there's a sign called scanning. And I got this sign, another story in a sense, I got this sign from watching the public in football, European football, soccer. When they stand up and sit down, making the wave, you know?
Right.
And I was in New York at the time, you know, in my apartment in New York City. And I saw that, this is years ago. And I saw that and I thought, oh, wow, okay, that's really interesting, you know? So I created this sign called scanning. And so my arm is rigid. I can explain it to you. Kind of hold your arm up and out to the side in a rigid. This is the preparation. Uh-huh. You hold your arm up out to the side, rigid, the palm facing the group. So it's like almost like a karate chop. And your arm is at a bit of an angle of about 45 degrees up, just directly out from the shoulder. And then you step into the so-called box, which is where all the action takes place when you're signing. It's the go area. To make things happen. The phrase happens in neutral. The go gestures happen in the box, so to speak.
Okay.
And so you move forward into the box and you keeping the arm rigid, you pass it over the heads of the people. Back and forth, you can use both arms, both rigid. You can go at different tempo with each arm. And the thing is that they respond only when the arm lines up with them, as long as they think it lines up with them. It's not an exact science. If they think it's lined up with them, the performer responds. And the performer, so this came from watching, you know, the crowd do the wave in European football. And to try to notate something like that would be a nightmare, especially if a sound painter is moving very quickly just with scanning. And if you have a group that understands what scanning is. And scanning is when my arm lines up with you, you get to play anything you want. You stay in your discipline by default. Unless you defaulted not to stay in the discipline. But by default, you stay in your discipline and you perform only when the arm lines up. And you can do anything you want. But there exists a development rate. It's called development rate 1. So as I'm scanning around, you're making the composition just with the form of the scanning, and also at the same time, maybe I'm looking for something to continue the direction of the composition. And so let's say I stop on somebody. Keeping my arm in their direction, then I give a continue gesture with the other hand, and the people that were in line of my arm will continue to perform without, they just continue, and they never stop. You never stop unless the sound painter stops you, or right. Unless you can't continue doing what you're doing. If it's ridiculously hard to do, you stop yourself and wait for the next sign. Right. But anyway, let's just say these people are doing something that's easy enough to do, and they continue, and they're developing at rate 1. development rate one, which is to develop your material slowly. So anyway, that's an aleatoric sign, mm-hmm. because I have no idea what they're going to do.
Right.
So I don't know what they're going to do. So the live composing works with kind of what you know is going to happen, like if it's a long tone or minimalism or, you know, dancer one mirrors dancer two, or actor one is improvising with one word, you know, mm-hmm. you know what's going to happen.
Right.
So more or less. But when you scan or some of the other chance gestures or aleatoric gestures, you're looking for material. That's one of the reasons for using it. And the other one is to just, you know, use the shape of what you're doing as part of the composition. And maybe you don't stop on anything. You only use the shape of what you're doing. So that's the aleatoric side to so sound painting works with the known and the unknown.
Yeah. So I saw an example online. There happened to be a performance on YouTube, or there's a number of them, but one I was looking at was to go back to this idea of you stay in your discipline. So I was watching, I saw, I think, probably musicians, actors, poets, all doing their thing. Is that basically what you're talking about?
You all stay within your discipline. So if you're a poet, you remain as a poet. You don't start dancing across the stage, you know, as a dancer.
Right.
If you're an actor, actors are a little bit more multidisciplinary anyway. But we default that actors mainly use their voice and they only move in certain situations. Uh-huh. Musicians, say, you know, a saxophone player would remain a saxophone player. He or she wouldn't just start speaking.
Right.
Unless you sign that the discipline is open to their choice. And then you might get an actor's or you might get a saxophone player speaking as a response instead of playing their instrument.
In conversation maybe with someone else's performance?
No, it depends on what the gesture is. Yeah. Gestures, everything has a very, very, very specific set of parameters, each gesture. Uh-huh. And if you perform the gesture correctly, then certain gestures would allow you to relate to somebody else and speak to them, and certain ones allow you to remain with what we call blinders. Perform as if you're the only person in the room. Mm. So this allows the sound painter to have, like, what happens in real life. When you're standing in Times Square, everybody doesn't know everybody else.
No.
So you get a dynamic from the crowd that's comes from the strength of each person. And it's the strength of each person in each situation that makes the entire setting strong. Hmm. So that's what happens in a sound painting. You either open it up that people can relate to each other, or you keep it closed, depending on the gesture, that they don't relate to each other. And that in itself creates a strength.
Yeah.
So there's certain signs, like one called Play Can't Play, that demands, in a way, that it's not demands, maybe it's too strong, that ask the performer, and this is one of the main rules, is to perform as if you're the only person in the room. And that particular gesture has a rate two development rate, level two development rate. So the language is not intuitive. Some signs you may be able to look at them and say they're symbolic of the sound or what is offered from that, like a long tone,
right,
or pointillism. It's a bit symbolic or iconic of the result. Uh-huh. But many of the signs, you can't look at the sign and figure out what's meant. Whereas in like the American Sign Language, there's many signs that are related to, you know, what they're trying to say. It's more symbolic. Hmm. You know, of the spoken word or of the, but in sound painting, that's not always true. It's not very true at all.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, Brief Expeditions into the Geographies of Everything and Nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. So I guess that's my the next question is especially maybe those people who come, the lawyer, the doctor, the person who doesn't have necessarily an artistic background. And maybe it's them that I'm directing this to the most, but it's you come to that. How does this raise our awareness of space? And whether that's a musical space, whether that's being on stage with each other, how does our spatial consciousness get raised? How does it raise through this? How is it developed through this?
I think it's raised through, I mean, almost like a physical, in a physical sense that, I mean, putting that, everybody, this may be a little bit kind of far-reaching what I'm saying, but this is how I see it, is that everybody has something to offer, you know, and everybody's offering in sound painting, speaking of using sound painting as a way to, it's a language of creativity, it really is, if you put it in simple terms, it's a sign language for creativity. Mm-hmm. You become aware of the person spatially, you know, the other people,
yeah,
in the room, in a different way than you become. Why? Because it's not something that another composer has put on them and they're playing their part. You know, it's all of a sudden, here's this person, you know, 20, 30, 40 meters away, you know, stage right, or in a rehearsal or in a conference or whatever. But here's this person over there. And that person is offering something that maybe some part of the group is not doing anything and are silent. And they're just simply taking in what that person's doing. And they're literally like over there somewhere, you know. So sound painting has a way of getting the people that are part of the group to be interested in all the other parts equally. And to accept that each part is as important as what they can offer. So that the very skilled performer, say the saxophone player again, who is very skilled on her instrument, is incredibly interested in what the lawyer is saying over there, responding to the same sign. So and incredibly interested, yeah, because the lawyer understands the sign and what he or she offers within that sign. And so there's this, you know, there's this kind of awareness of the richness of the individual that comes out of a sound painting, you know, rehearsal, performance, whatever. And I don't know, does that answer your question?
It does. I mean, it's reminding people in some ways, or in showing them, sometimes perhaps even for the first time, how this connection that we have with the people around us that are unlike how some of our philosophy, Kantian philosophy, says that we're discrete and we're separate kind of individuals. This might even just show people that there is some more of a connection. I've heard people refer to it like walking down, we'll use the New York example again, walking down a sidewalk and then realizing you're walking at the same pace as somebody right next to you. And,
right.
And then feeling connected to them, and how the times I've read this, it describes how powerful that experience is for someone who's sort of just kind of caught into perhaps a, here to use that rhythm kind of talk again, the speaking right. of rhythm, caught in this more dominant sort of rhythm of going to work, a very rigid kind of scheduled kind of routine, and then to kind of then feel part of like maybe someone else's being inside their bubble, so to speak, that how powerful that could be. So I'm assuming, and I guess that's where my question comes from in some ways to you, is do people walk away with that? And is that some of the feedback you get from people? Wow, that felt pretty powerful.
That's well put. Exactly. I like that analogy, walking next to somebody and how, because we all know that.
Yeah.
And we walk next to somebody and we feel connected in a way, you know, and you know, you almost know that the person's thinking about you too, you know. So there's an actual, like, you know, you're really aware. You're both usually aware, usually.
Right.
So the sound painting, one of the things I've experienced that really speaks to this is in sound painting rehearsals, performances, whatever, is afterwards the group feels like a family, you know. to use that word in a broad sense. Right. They feel very much connected with each other because, like that walking next to somebody in Times Square, you know, and being aware and feeling a certain strength and power from that and energy from that, and a certain like, oh, we are connected, aren't we? As in quantum physics, we are all connected, mm-hmm. you know. So there's this sense after a rehearsal of family. And I think that comes from this, as you're suggesting, the sense of walking next to somebody. There's so much of this, as if you will, walking next to each other that happens in a sound painting group that it doesn't matter if you're not as good on your instrument, so to speak, as the next person. It's because of what you did at the time of that gesture, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, all of this stuff I didn't think about in the beginning. You know, this was just a tool, a system before it became a language that I made up to support a moment of frustration I had.
It's amazing. You know? And then what it's turned into is it's kind of an amazing story.
And then I kept on developing it. And as it developed, I developed with it. You know, I started to look at it and go, well, I mean, this is interesting. It actually has, a philosophy has grown out of this, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't just in sound painting. Nothing's created in a vacuum. I mean, people like Miles Davis and Pablo Picasso and Eva Hesse and everybody worked with chance and, you know, and things happening by, you know, a so-called mistake is not a mistake. It's an opportunity for exploration, you know.
Right.
And a lot of people have said this, but this has really become a real fixed part of sound painting, these specific rules. And when everybody understands and kind of shares that philosophy, and it's not rigid in any kind of way, and not at all, it's you know, it allows all kinds of things to happen without judgment. Yeah. And when people you know are in a group, and the group is, you know, is sort of, you know, all working together in this way, they really, after the performances and rehearsals, they stay in touch with each other for a long time. They often get back together and will often bring me like a group of people. Maybe it's their first time for a workshop. They get back together and they form a collective, and then they bring me back to kind of fine tune the group. And the next thing you know, they're a really fine sound painting orchestra made up of people from all walks of life, you know?
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. To find out more about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. To give some feedback or suggestion for a future episode, go to the comments section on the website, or go to the blog and enter into the conversation. Has your process through, like you said, you started out kind of by chance in some ways. You tried something out of frustration, perhaps, and then,
yes. You
know, we're talking, this was 1974, you said, so this is 40 years later now.
And exactly.
It's developed into something, you know, fairly big. It's this whole language with, 1,500 signs. Has this journey, so to speak, kind of influenced now? I guess what I really want to get at is you've learned from the city and developed signs. Does it now influence the way you read cities?
Absolutely. The way I read everything.
Everything, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a cool question. It's a very nice question because it's not, there's other sound painters. Every year we have the sound painting think tank. This year will be number 21, I think.
Oh, wow.
And there are conferences where sound painters come together and we yak about sound painting and share ideas and maybe develop some new signs, whatever. But the conversation we're having here about has it, you know, changed the way I kind of like, you know, look back out at everything. and the way I deal with life, and the way I might take in a problem that day, and how I might be able to deal with someone who's driving too slow in front of me,
right.
Or, you know, or how I look at a city, you know, it absolutely has changed that. You know, a sound painting has absolutely changed the way I deal with the structures of life that come at me every day, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it absolutely has taught me that, you know, never, you do, don't, you can plan a skeleton for your future, but I mean, even that's not maybe going to happen. So it's taught me that whatever kind of comes at you, you have to learn how to deal with it. And sound painting is a real practice for that. So I look at things and I think about how they might be in a composition, or I look at a city or a town or something, and that influences me. And the sound painting itself has influenced how I look at things. And yes, and other sound painters that have been doing this 10 years and more describe the same feeling. That it's really changed how they look at their life.
Yeah.
And I mean that in a way that's sort of, I mean it in a simple way, because there's so many things in our life affect us, you know. So many things that we do affect us. And so this is just one more thing that affects us as humans. But I think it affects me in a different way, because the whole idea of being able to deal with what comes at you is what you have to do as a sound painter. And how you use anything, and how you look at the different disciplines, and how you look at things structurally. And so looking back at life, also you see things in a different way because of sound painting. The same way the visual artist or the photographer, like my brother Richard, was a photographer for many years, and he could take a photo of something, and then I would turn around and take the same photo, and it would look nothing like his.
Right.
You know, because he looked at things with a whole different eye. And literally it was the same photo, but there was something about the composition that just, mine didn't work in the same way his did.
Yeah. You know?
Because his eye was trained in that way. And so he, of course, looked at life totally differently because of, as a musician, trained musician since I was a child, sounds are something that hit me in a whole different way than other people, you know?
So you have a sensitivity for sound.
I hear
sound.
Everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so with sound painting, as yet one more tool that makes you look at structures, because sound painting is all about structuring. You know, life is this thing that's kind of flowing forward, and it's you never know what's going to happen with it. It's just, this is flowing this way, this is flowing that way, this goes this direction, this is standing here for a while. And that's what happens in live composition. You like set the thing in motion, you know, you give the gesture, the first, let's just talk, speaking about a performance, you put the piece in motion and it's driving by itself now. Now it's your job to like shape and structure it and to set it on its path this way or that way, and to look what's going on over here, to leave that alone for a while, only for 20 seconds, because it's perfect for the composition to leave it alone for 20 seconds while you modify or shape or structure this next section, and then you call up for something new and da 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 da. And in a way, life is just kind of this thing that flows forward, and without something like sound painting, but a composition in real time is like life flowing forward, but you have the tool of sound painting to shape and structure that into composition. That makes any sense?
No, it does. So yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? So then that in itself gives you a whole a different perspective of how one might look at life, you know?
I guess on this show, geographical imaginations, the idea of maps, we like to take it kind of broadly speaking, kind of think of it in different ways. You're going on stage really without a map, but you are mapping. You're trying to map something out in some ways.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm going to create my own map.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm the person that puts a backpack on and just buys a ticket and lands somewhere and starts walking, you know?
Yeah. And take it all in.
Yeah, and take it all in. And okay, how do I deal with it now as it comes at me? And it's another way of looking at composition, you know, and frankly, it's there's quite a lot of sound painting in education, because I think it's much needed to develop at any level of education, but starting with children, to develop, to foster this creativity that's already inherent in every single child. And this kind of way of dealing with whatever the person offers has been there's a lot of discussions going on about this in education, and how sound painting is applied in education, and how it opens this up, and how, you know, that it levels the playing field for all the children.
Right.
Anybody can be in a group. You know, if they don't have enough instruments, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Still join the orchestra.
Right.
You know, so then again, this speaks back to the whole social thing, that nobody's left out. And if you want to be a part of it, you won't be left out. If you can't sing, of course you can sing. You know, maybe you don't sound like the trained singer, but you can sing. It's all a matter of spirit, you know?
Yeah, and it's the spirit of the artistic practice, or the spirit, right, of being an artist. It's not trying, we're not talking about you have to paint a landscape painting on your first day if you've never done this before.
No, yes, absolutely. Hopefully not, yes. Right. Although I love landscapes, but my gosh, if you're going to get so rigid into it from the get-go, then you're going to close some doors.
Right, and that's, so it's about opening doors, really.
It's about opening doors. Sound painting education is really about opening doors.
So we've reached the end of another episode, and we want to thank Walter Thompson for sharing his ideas with us, for helping us start what I hope might be a series of portraits of rhythm analysts. It's a bit of a take from the book by Henri Lefebvre, a French theorist, his book Rhythm Analysis, where he too offers up a portrait of a rhythm analyst. And it's from there that I've gone out and looked in the world a little bit to find people doing similar things to what Henri Lefebvre was talking about. And so we thank Walter Thompson for being the first, and I felt was an exciting conversation with him, and look forward to others down the road. So without any further, this has been episode 9. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned next month for our next episode. Que les vaya bien. Ciao.